Hey, Dad.
Yeah, Logan.
Who was the biggest financial wizard in the Bible?
I don't know. Who would that be?
Noah, because he was floating his stock while everyone else was in liquidation.
I'm not your real dad.
Oh, no. This is the worst possible time to make that announcement.
You're listening to The Wayward Willis with John and Logan, where two atheists discuss religion, culture, and maybe some politics. If you're offended by blasphemy, profanity, or you hate fun, this podcast may not be right for you. And now, on to the show.
Hey, you.
It's us.
Not so distant relatives of the Red Panda.
I'm your host, John.
And I'm Logan, a death row inmate.
This week, we need you to just trust that we're right and that we would never lie to you because we only have your best interests at heart.
And also probably want something from you.
For you. We want something for you.
Oh, right.
We're talking about indoctrination.
So what even is indoctrination?
Well, the dictionary defines indoctrination as imbuing with a usually partisan or sectarian opinion, point of view, or principle. Basically, we're talking about filling someone's head with your ideas in the hope that they'll become the other person's ideas so they can turn around and make someone else's ideas your ideas. Or your ideas, someone else's ideas. It's all very confusing. What I'm suggesting here is telepathic mind control.
So what you're saying is we're going to just tell everyone not to think about elephants, right?
Not to think about them. Do not think about elephants, especially pink ones.
You got fucking roasted, guys, because now you're thinking about pink elephants.
So indoctrination isn't specific to any single ideology or hive mind thought pattern, but the root word is doctrine, which means a principle or position.
Not a school principal, though.
Or missionary position.
Oh, God.
This principle or position could be anything from belief in God to pizza parlor child sex rings to the very idea that Superman could ever be considered a valid comic book hero.
Okay, well, first of all, that was quite the leap you made there. And second of all, I hold as much disdain for DC as the next guy, but I'm not quite sure that Superman can be considered an invalid, quote-unquote, comic book hero.
Well, he's basically an indestructible god. His only weakness is tiny little chunks of his home planet, which seem to be very plentiful in the universe for some goddamn reason. But I mean,
couldn't the same be said for, like, Vision in the Marvel universe? So I feel like your point is starting to have some holes poked in it.
Well, fuck Superman, unless it's Christopher Reeve.
Oh, okay, good point. Moving on.
When we're talking about religion, indoctrination manifests itself as the get them while they're young mantra, which sounds creeptastic and icky.
Putting aside the fact that creeptastic is not a real word, that does indeed sound horrifying.
Creeptastic is a real word. What? If you can say it, it's a real word.
That's not how that works.
If you can say it, it's a real word.
Glamzambanobalips.
That's a word now, too.
What the fuck?
What this suggests is that small children have to trust adults for survival, and because of that, tend to believe what adults tell them. Easy examples would be Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and gods.
And that some creepy fairy breaks into your room at night to pawn off your molars. What kind of eerie crap is that?
That's actually disgusting.
You used to partake in it, though.
Oh, you were so gullible.
What the fuck?
Aristotle said, "Give me the child until he is seven, and I will show you the man." He did not mean that seven-year-old children are men, especially girls.
What are you trying to say, boy?
That girls are not men.
Are you trying to assume their gender?
I think that was just a simple fact. I mean, if you identify as a girl, you're not going to be a man.
Maybe to you, but you don't know anything.
Moving on. What Aristotle did mean is that children are pliable and absorb knowledge at a greater rate than adults because they don't really have any preconceptions about what they know or believe. The things they learn when they're young, presumably younger than seven, tend to shape the way they see the world as they grow older.
Which is why you should never share your political views with your kid, lest they go to school and get in trouble for calling Trump an asshole in the middle of class without having any idea why they feel that way.
Or throw up a Sieg Heil in the middle of the freaking Pledge of Allegiance or something.
Heil Hitler!
Oh, no. This is not that podcast.
Oh, my bad. Sorry. I get them confused all the time.
Oh, jeez. So our perceptions of the world shape our beliefs and actions. So indoctrination is particularly horrible when the ideas are bad. Indoctrination doesn't even have to be intentional, though we typically tie it to purposeful teachings rather than behavioral examples.
Shoo-be-doo. I want to be like you. I want to walk like you, talk like you, do like you.
Logan, please, just keep it to the bare necessities.
Wow.
So, for example, a boy growing up in a home with a misogynistic, abusive father could form the idea that women are inferior and should be treated like shit, even though his father may not have ever said anything to that effect. Not explicitly, anyway.
This was actually a whole episode of Criminal Minds. Such a good show.
That is such a good show.
Yeah, I just said it is.
No, that was my idea. Unless the child is exposed to contrary ideas, he may grow up to continue the cycle and become an abusive asshole himself. In this case, you could say that the child was indoctrinated into misogyny and abuse, even though nobody sat him down and told him this was the way he should think and act.
Although I feel like that would be an even more uncomfortable talk to have with your kid than the birds and the bees. Well, I guess only if you aren't a misogynistic asshole.
Yeah, I think that if you swing that way, then sitting your kid down and telling him that women are pieces of shit would probably not really be that uncomfortable to you.
Swing that way being like a right hook into your woman's mouth.
Oh,
it was an abuse joke.
Does not in any way condone violence against women. Even Eve.
No, fuck Eve.
But this kind of teaching by example is a little bit more subtle than the indoctrination we're talking about when we're talking about religion. Religions have very specific dogma and doctrine that has been recorded and codified. This is then taught to all adherents and their children as absolute truth and as a moral framework for living their lives. In some cases, when the dogma has been watered down to only the nice parts, you can get people who view their religion as a basis for treating people kindly and being charitable.
I'm actually rather fond of these folks.
Me too. I don't think we really have to worry about those people too much. Others aren't quite as good at cherry-picking nice stuff out of all the garbage and end up being insufferable fuckhats like Bill Donahue, Pat Robertson, and Mike Pence. Not that I would name names. Mike.
I feel like saying not that I would name names immediately after listing off a bunch of names is sort of sarcastic. Is that what you were going for? Is that sarcasm?
I was laying it on pretty thick.
Does not compute.
Indoctrination is the easiest when you're working with clean slates, and in most cases, when a child is born into a religious family, the indoctrination begins when the child is born. I, for example, attended church from before I even had a sense of self, up until my sense of self became more important than unquestioning belief.
Even if that sense of self was the perception that you were a human garbage bag.
But I'm not. I am, however, ashamed to say that that took me about 28 years to complete.
Unlike some of us who have always been self-important and egocentric. You can't see it, but I just did a hair flip.
It was a good one, too.
Oh, thanks.
But because of the constant barrage of Jesus I was getting from the day I was born, I totally bought into religion, just like my parents wanted. I accepted Jesus into my heart when I was around 4 years old and was baptized in the Pacific Ocean.
Is that why you're so salty now?
No, it's because I'm old.
Oh, roasted.
Most of my childhood was pretty unremarkable, so I don't have a whole lot of memories, but I do remember that day vividly because it was so emotional. That's the power of religious indoctrination.
And the power of Pine Sol, baby.
Another sponsorship?
Oh yeah, we've got you accidentally.
Prominent secular figures like Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens have said in very plain language that they view religious indoctrination of children as child abuse. I don't know that either of them were calling for it to be outlawed because they also both believed in the separation of church and state when they said this.
The police can't fix morals after all.
And thought crimes are not a thing we want. I wouldn't want the government to pass laws against parents who teach their children religion, even though I oppose childhood indoctrination, because I believe this is an overreach by a government that would give too much power to dictate the personal lives of everyone, religious and non-religious. Seriously, government, stay out of my house.
Also, can you imagine if this actually did become something that was illegal to do? In jail, one person would be like, I gutted my boss on the shop floor because he didn't give me a raise. What are you in for? And the other person would be like, well, I left my Bible laying out on the kitchen table and my kids got a hold of it.
Oh, that would be a weird world. So I do, however, believe that overtly abusive religious practices like corporal punishment and circumcision should be monitored and prosecuted the same as any other form of abuse. I just think the line is really gray and it's not an easy situation to deal with.
Would you say the line has 50 shades?
No, 49. Copyright violation. 49 shades of gray. So when small children are the target of indoctrination, it's very important to make the material palatable to a young mind.
And a short attention span.
Fact. That means cartoons, toys, and books that get the basic doctrine across but tie it in with subjects and situations with which children are more familiar. You and I are both very familiar with the Christian video series VeggieTales.
Broccoli, celery, gotta be
VeggieTales.
VeggieTales.
So this is straight up indoctrination because it gets small children engaged with funny characters and memorable songs before launching into full-blown supernaturalism.
Not the Sam and Dean Winchester kind, though.
You're right. It also, more disgustingly, makes horrible stories like Noah's Ark, the Battle of Jericho, and Moses' showdown with Pharaoh look cute and silly. None of these stories are cute and silly, and no child should be able to accept them the way they would a Calvin and Hobbes comic.
But let's be honest, that's sort of like fairy tales. Like, there are Grimm Brothers versions, and then there are the cute bedtime story versions, and they all stem from the same source material, but the cute versions leave out all the blood and gore.
Yeah, the problem with that is the Disney versions of fairy tales aren't trying to teach you how to live your life or dictate how you should treat others.
I think that might be false, though, because like some of the not Disney versions, just like the fairy tale books, are like moralistic, where they're like, this is how like people are supposed to be, and here's a good, valuable lesson you can learn from this.
All right.
Fucking roasted.
So think about all of the depictions you've seen of Noah's Ark. You see giraffe heads poking out of windows and lions chilling out with kangaroos and penguins.
Because who needs proper climate and living conditions? Certainly not the animals of the ark.
You see doves and you see rainbows. It's always adorable. What you don't see is men, women, and children trying and failing to swim in a flash flood, gasping for breath.
Okay, well...
You don't see corpses bumping up against the hull of the Ark.
I mean, yeah, but...
You don't see piles of rotting carcasses littering the ground after all the waters recede.
Wow, you took that to a whole other level.
Well, where did you think the bodies went?
The void, duh.
Oh, right. So, of course, the grown-up version of that story doesn't go into much detail either, and the religious people don't want to think too deeply about the carnage their god leaves in his wake.
We should have Stephen King do a rewrite of the Bible.
Oh my god, that would be amazing. Okay, Patreon goal? 2 bucks.
Okay.
You also don't think about the fact that after God murdered everyone on the planet except for one family, that family repopulated the planet via incest.
Keeping it in the family. All right.
All right.
All right.
Because of the way these stories are shrouded with decency and cherry-picked to make someone's point, it's possible to make indoctrination work on adults as well.
Anything is possible. You've just gotta believe.
Whether the person is prone to superstition or finds themselves at a low point in their life, religion has something to offer them. It could be a way to feel more comfortable with death. It could be a way to absolve themselves of responsibility for something bad they did. It could be a desperate need for a community and a feeling of belonging.
Or it could just be the 72 virgins thing.
Okay, sign me up. Whatever the reason, religions are very practiced at finding and exploiting it. You and I both had experience with a sort of forced religious practice in the military, where if you didn't attend church services, you were essentially punished by having to do manual labor in the barracks or whatever. If you didn't want to be put to work, your alternative was to go to church and sit on your ass listening to nonsense with all the other slackers.
Which is why I chose door number 3 and became a church escort, which meant that I got to lead flights of troops to the churches and then eat cake while everyone attended the service. Oh yeah, loopholes, motherfucker.
Wait, you were an escort?
No.
Military gigolo.
All right, you're done. We're finished. Wrap it up. We're done. Let's go home.
So the most egregious example of indoctrination is the captive audience. And by captive, I mean actual prisoners. America's prison system is rife with religious programs and groups that reach prisoners at the lowest points in their lives with broken will and nowhere to go.
The law may not forgive you for your crimes, but God certainly will, friendo.
Yep. Given that our culture sort of hands passes to people who profess a belief in a higher power, it becomes an incentive to participate in religious programs in the hope for a better outcome with the parole board or general treatment and privilege while serving a sentence.
I did a Jesus thing. Can I go home now?
Yep, you're done. It would also help avoid a feeling of being ostracized by peers. Again, religion is great at building communities of religious people and shunning non-believers.
Shun the non-believer. Oh, God, that's the second Charlie the Unicorn reference I've made in the last two episodes. I need to be stopped.
I don't know. Who doesn't like Charlie?
Charlie! We're going to Candy Mountain, Charlie!
The problem with indoctrination is that it relies on the target's lack of interest in doing a whole lot of research and critical thinking. Obviously, small children don't have the ability or the time to do this. They're way too busy singing Silly Songs with Larry.
And now it's time for Silly Songs with Larry, the part of the show where Larry comes out and sings a silly song.
But when indoctrinated people are exposed to new ideas and ways of thinking, the indoctrination often starts to lose its grip as the person starts to realize that they didn't choose to believe what they believe. They were told to believe it, and not question. Sometimes this happens very quickly in a eureka moment, and other times it takes years or decades to work through.
Gadzooks!
Our guest this week spends his time pointing out the silliness of unquestioning belief and the problems of indoctrination. This week, we're talking to atheist, skeptic, Christian book critic, and YouTuber Steve Shives. How are you today?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
That's awesome. Well, we're talking about indoctrination this week, and your recent Atheist Reads series made me think of you for this episode. So let's talk about this video series for just a second. How many Christian books have you read, both on and off channel?
Well, the number is basically the same. I may have read a few more than the ones I've done for the series, but for the most part, it's just been for the series. I'm on 22. The last one I did was number 22.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So you're not just reading them for fun?
No. I mean, the first one I ever did, the first series was about the case for Christ. And I was given that years before YouTube even existed. I was dating someone who was a Christian, and I was not yet an atheist, but I was not a Christian. You know, I was just sort of in kind of a religious no man's land. And she said, well, look, read this, you know. So I read it. I read The Case for Christ, and I read it back then, and I thought, there's something about this that just doesn't seem right to me. And I couldn't put my finger on exactly what it was, and I couldn't formulate like a specific response to what it was about that book that I didn't quite connect with. But then years later, when I went back to it, I figured it out for the series. But yeah, other than things like that, I've been reading apologetics for the YouTube series, and that's about it. So yeah, 22 and counting.
Wow. Okay. And probably what 22 of them were just really convincing, right?
Yeah. It kind of tells you how effective it was on me anyway, that the series is still called An Atheist Reads and I'm on 22. So I haven't quite been convinced yet.
Okay. So 21 of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah. So the last book that you read on your series was by Natasha Crane called Keeping Your Kids on God's Side, which what a stupid title. But this book was basically suggesting feeding apologetics to children. And yeah. I mean, apologetics and children. Do you just find this as disgusting as I do?
Yeah. And I do. I mean, there's nothing wrong. To me, at least to my mind, there's nothing wrong with teaching children about religion, and there's nothing wrong with a person who is of a particular faith, like passing that faith on to a child. But I personally would be more comfortable if it were done in a way of, you know, here's what I believe, and maybe when you get older, maybe you'll believe this too, or maybe you'll believe something else. Like, I feel like it's a mark of maturity for a religious believer to, even if you do sincerely believe whatever you believe, to at least acknowledge that a lot of your belief rests on some things that can't be verified. and to just say, okay, I think this is true, but it might not be. And there's not a whole lot of evidence for this, but I believe it for some other reason.
Right.
And, And if you pass that on to your kids, make sure that is reflected. You know, don't teach it to your kids as though it's a stone cold, undeniable fact when it's not. And apologetics is particularly bad, because not only does it give you these sort of, you know, weighted arguments in favor of the religion, Christianity in this case, that makes it seem like it's a much stronger case than it is, but apologists also usually misrepresent, you know, the arguments against their position or the evidence against their position. They almost always, like when they talk about evolution, they almost always get it wrong. When they talk about other religions, they almost always get it wrong. When they talk about philosophy, they almost always get it wrong. And they don't really change if they're corrected. You know, if someone says, actually, that's not what postmodernism is, that it doesn't make a difference. They keep saying the same thing they were saying all along. So yeah, it's a really, really bad thing to introduce a child to, especially the way Crane does it in her book, because it's basically just a grown-up's apologetics book with every once in a while she throws in a, this is important, tell your kids about this. You know what I mean?
Right. And you definitely pointed that out while you were reviewing the book. And it did strike me that she was, you know, basically giving the William Lane Craig apologetics handbook to small children who, you know, you can't deny that a child is not going to be able to process that and really use it or, you know, apply it. And I think that, as is the case with a lot of religion, you know, Bible school and prayers, where a lot of it is just rote memorization. And if, you know, what she is suggesting is that your kids will have this strong foundation in God if they memorize these arguments, well, then she's not really, you know, accomplishing what she's trying to accomplish. She's just creating more little mindless robots to walk around and spew these arguments out to people.
Yeah, exactly. It's the kind of critical thinking that apologists recommend to adults, which is to say, not really critical thinking at all, because you don't start with your conclusion and then work backwards. So apologists, they start with their conclusion. They know where they want to end up, which is Jesus Christ is Lord, the resurrection happened, you know, you need to believe in Jesus for salvation. All the basic, all the big Christian beliefs, they know that that's where they want to end up. And then they reason backwards from that. And that is not critical thinking. And that's not the scientific method. That's motivated reasoning and bias and all these things that you're taught to try as best as you can to avoid when you're conducting an investigation or trying to find the truth about something. And it's even more compounded when it's a parent or a teacher telling it to a child. You know, if you're a trusted adult and a child looks to you as a source of information or a source of wisdom, and you're telling them, okay, well, here's the way it is, and if anybody disagrees with you, here are some arguments you can make, you know, against that. And, you know, a child is just going to receive that,
right,
and say, okay, you know, because they're not equipped yet to figure their own way around it. And yeah, it's not, to me, it is not a good way to raise kids to be able to think for themselves and to reason. It does the kids a disservice. And it really sort of shows how paltry the case, the scientific case or the historical evidence-based case for your religion is, if you're resorting to, you know, telling the kids about it before they can even think about it for themselves.
Right. Well, and I think that there are two things that I would point out along those lines. And that is, one, there really isn't any reason given or there isn't any discussion opened about why somebody would dissent from these ideas or why someone would be disagreeing with you. And two is, there is absolutely no care given to alternatives. And obviously, when your goal is to have your kid go to church, you don't want an alternative. That would defeat your goal. But at the same time, if you can't, you know, at least tell them, you know, some people don't believe this, they believe this instead, or they don't believe any of it or anything like that, then the kid, just all they know is that the people that they know and trust and the people who are in authority over them believe this, so that's what everyone believes.
Yeah. As I've said many times, when people in other YouTube videos I make, sometimes I do a question and answer video, and occasionally for some reason people will ask my advice on things, and I'm grateful for that, but I don't understand that. because I'm not like, I don't view myself as a really good source of wisdom. But you know, they'll ask like, how do you think I should teach my child about politics or about atheism or religion without indoctrinating them into what I believe? Like, they don't want to just, you know, pass their opinions on to the child as though it's fact, but they want to be able to talk with their kids about stuff. And the best I've ever been able to come up with is just frame it as what you believe. Tell them what you think and tell them why you think it. So if you're a Christian and you want to pass your religion on to your children, I mean, I'm an atheist. I don't think Christianity is real. I don't think there's truth there. But, you know, you have a right to tell your kid about your religion if that's important to you. But frame it as, this is what I believe, and this is why I believe it. These are the things that brought me to this belief. And there are other people who believe other things, and they have a right to believe their things too. And there are some people who believe that there aren't, that no religion is true, that God doesn't exist, that these things just didn't happen. And they have their reasons for believing that. And, you know, when you grow up or when you reach a more mature age and you can think about these questions for yourself and do your own research or what have you, you can come to your own conclusion. And maybe you'll wind up believing something like I believe, or maybe you'll believe something completely different. But that way you avoid that sense of indoctrination. You know, it's not just, okay, now I'm going to tell you about Jesus, and you give them a Sunday school lesson as though that's literally what happened in history.
Right.
When in some cases we know that didn't happen, and in most other cases we have no way of knowing if that happened or not. It's completely unverifiable, you know?
Right. And I think that, you know, if you're trying to teach your children and you're trying to keep from indoctrinating them either intentionally or unintentionally, mm-hmm. then yeah, just like you said, if you position it as this is what I think and this is what I believe, if you follow that up with what do you think or what do you believe,
yeah.
then you can enter into a discussion that becomes an exchange rather than a lecture.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I've found that to be the most fruitful method for engaging with religious folks as an adult too. I don't like having arguments with people. I don't like having debates with people. I like having conversations with people. So if I were going to talk to a Christian person about their beliefs and they wanted to talk to me about my lack of those beliefs, you know, I prefer asking them those sorts of questions. You know, well, what do you believe? Why do you believe that? You know, not in an accusatory way, just in a conversational, like out of curiosity. You know, what is it that has led you to believe these things? You know, and if you're curious, well, here's why I believe the things that I believe. It's much more fruitful in terms of understanding where another person stands. And it's a much better way of getting them to understand where you are, you know, instead of sitting someone down and saying, okay, your religion's wrong, and here's what's wrong with it, and here's why I'm right. You know, that can be really entertaining for people who are already on your side. And, yeah, look at the atheist tear up that Christian. But if you want the Christian to understand you, then it's much better to frame it as a conversation. And I think that can work when you're trying to share that kind of thing with a child as well.
Right, because it doesn't immediately shut them down. And right. Yeah, so we've mentioned on this podcast the use of the Socratic method and, you know, just kind of probing to get a little more depth and to encourage more conversation rather than less. So, yeah. I mean, I think that that's definitely a thing that you can do to avoid indoctrination, but it's also a thing that you can do to really kind of have a meaningful conversation and try to figure out why somebody believes something and maybe get them to figure out why they believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. And also to help you understand for yourself why they believe it. I mean, a lot of us look at the Socratic method as a way of arguing, as a way of, you know, you sort of tease out what a person really believes and with the idea of, well, you know, I'll get them to realize on their own why they, you know, maybe why their reasons for believing something aren't valid or whatever. And you can use it for that, but it can also be just a way of learning something for yourself. You know, you ask a person, you say, oh, why do you believe that? Okay. Well, that's interesting. Tell me more about that. You know, it allows you to understand where the other person is coming from, and, you know, grows your own understanding of their position. which is, it's one of the reasons that I still do the apologetics reviews, because I've done so many of them, and the new arguments are few and far between. I find myself going back through the same material from different authors, you know, over and over again. And a lot of the reason that I still feel like it's worth doing is to represent a particular atheist response to these arguments. You know, I always say, like, this is me. This is just my response to this. This isn't the definitive response. This isn't what every atheist should say or anything like that. This is just how I react to it and I respond to it as an atheist reading these arguments. And it helps me to understand where the Christian author is coming from. And hopefully anyone who watches the videos will understand where I, as one particular atheist, is coming from, and will help to facilitate that kind of an understanding if somebody's interested in that.
Yeah, that's good. And it's good to have reasons for your stances.
Yeah.
And I find that a lot of people, when they are just steeped in religion, especially from a very young age, it doesn't come with reasons. It just comes with belief. But what I wanted to ask you was to kind of back up and then come into this conversation another way. Do you have a childhood experience with indoctrination? Did you grow up religious?
I grew up in a nominally Christian household. We weren't super religious, but we were Christian sort of by default. Like, that was just kind of the worldview. And it was just sort of assumed that, yeah, well, you know, the Bible's pretty much true, you know, and Jesus was a real person, and all the big things that, you know, Jesus supposedly did or said, that's all true. But we didn't go to church except for about a year when I was 7 or 8 years old, mostly because my dad didn't really like any of the churches in the neighborhood. And he just and my dad's not really a church going guy either. He's just not. He always said, you know, if I went to church, I feel like I would have to stop drinking and cussing. And I just don't want to do that. Because the idea was, like, if I go to church as the person I am now, then I'll feel like I'm a hypocrite because I get, you know, I go out with my friends and drink a beer and swear on the weekends. But if I stop doing that in order to not be a hypocrite at church, I would be miserable. So I'm just not going to church.
I feel like that's a very honest stance on the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's, I feel like I picked up a little bit of that. But yeah, so we weren't super religious. My mom's family was. My mom's dad, my maternal grandfather, was a preacher. We didn't see him very much. He lived in the area, but he just didn't come around all that often. So I wasn't really indoctrinated by him, but there was that sort of, you know, just general assumption from birth that, well, Christianity is true and God is real and Jesus is real. And that's just kind of the way it is. And it was never pushed on me. It was just sort of always there. The one experience I do remember that wound up being something that I've returned to over and over again, trying to figure out if it was some kind of, like, a formative experience or, you know, a branching off point that eventually led me to rejecting Christianity and then ultimately religion in general, was there was one time when he came over, my grandfather on my mom's side came over to our house, and he was just visiting, hanging out in the living room. And before he left, he led us all in a prayer. And we never did that. And I remember thinking, like, we only do this when he's here, you know, like, we never said grace before meals. I never saw my parents pray. Like, we were never a pious family in any respect.
Okay.
But whenever my grandfather would be there, he would lead us in a prayer before he left. And it was like, you know, bow your heads, close your eyes. Dear Lord, thank you for this time together. It was like saying a blessing over a meal, but there wasn't any food. And I realized that at some point, like, we don't ever do this. Why do we do this when he's here? You know, or why do we let him do this when this isn't what we do? You know what I mean? And it felt kind of like he was, in a very gentle way, like he was sort of forcing it on us, you know, like, we don't do this, but we're doing it because he's here. Like, he's brought this in, you know what I mean?
Right.
And that realization, I think, was an important one for me, you know? So even though we were a Christian family, we didn't participate in it in that way. And when he came in and was like, all right, let's have a prayer, it was sort of like, well, but why? We don't ever do that. You know, like, right. We just don't do that.
So when did you finally become a devil worshiper?
Everybody becomes a devil worshiper when they're a teenager, right? Everybody goes through the devil worship phase.
Well, all the cool kids are doing it. Go.
Yeah. Go. The devil's music. I'd be like, Dad, you listened to this stuff when you were a kid. You didn't. You weren't born listening to mainstream country music. You used to listen to this stuff.
Oh, jeez.
You remember who you were, Dad. No, I got out of Christianity, my very informal sort of casual version of Christianity that I had with my family. I got out of that, I guess, when I was a teenager, maybe when I was about 16 or 17, I just kind of decided, you know, I just don't think that's it. You know, like whatever it is, I don't think Christianity is it. I think maybe some of it's true. Maybe there's some wisdom to be found in there. But, you know, the Garden of Eden, the flood, I just don't think any of that stuff happened, you know. And from there, I just sort of moved on in stages. You know what I mean? Like I called myself a deist for a while, where I decided, you know what? I don't think Christianity is true. I don't really think any particular religion has it right. But I read Voltaire, and Voltaire wrote an essay on religion where he describes a dream that he had, where he was visited by an image of Jesus, and Jesus gave him a tour of this wasteland where there were all these there were different religious figures, and there was a huge pile of bones that Voltaire was shown by Jesus, and Voltaire said, "Wow, whose bones are those?" And Jesus said, "Those are the bones of all of the people that have been killed in my name." And and Voltaire was like, "Well, that's messed up." And Jesus is like, "I know, right? It's not cool." And the point of the essay was basically there was a point in the essay where the Jesus character says to Voltaire, "All I said was love God and love other people. And anything else that anybody attributed to me as a teaching is something that somebody else made up. Like, that's all I wanted people to do, was love each other and love God. And that's it." And Voltaire said, "Well, if that's the truth, then you and me are cool, Jesus." And for a while, that I kind of adopted that, like, as my, that was my religion. Just love other people and love God and you're cool. And I stayed there for a while. I was in that deist sort of frame of mind for a long time. And then eventually I just kind of dropped the God part. I just said, you know, and it was because I realized that I just didn't believe it. I mean, it just came down to that. Like, it wasn't that I got rid of the God part of that on purpose because I felt like there was something wrong with it. I just realized I just didn't think it was real. And I finally just had to admit that to myself and say, yeah, okay, I don't think there is a God. There's just no reason to think there is one. There's no evidence compelling me to believe in it. You know, I don't believe in leprechauns either. Like, it might be.
Oh, now
cool.
We're in trouble. You brought up the leprechauns.
I know. Oh, and I'll bring up Santa too, so we can hit that one as well.
Oh, no.
The Santa syndrome. It's not the same. Okay.
Hey, we should totally have held different. Off for a little while longer. We could have started the war on Christmas.
Oh, man. Well, no, but I thought that they don't do that anymore. We're saying Merry Christmas again.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're making Christmas great again.
Yeah, it's all over. The war on Christmas, which was totally real, is now completely over. Yeah.
Well, I have nothing to live for now through the end of the year.
I know. God.
Jeez. I was stop being an atheist.
I was so looking forward to getting in people's faces whenever they said Merry Christmas, which as an atheist, I always do. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just like when somebody says bless you. I mean, you just have to completely lose your shit, right?
Yeah. You turn the table over. You know, you don't have to stand for that. Like, what are you saying? Well, bless who? Who's blessing who?
Flipping tables.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, in the name of religious tolerance.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, when I was very, very, very little, essentially, I had grown up in the church since the Sunday after I was born. And I don't think that's really an exaggeration. And so, you know, at a very, very, very young age, I had been very deeply indoctrinated. And I, you know, walked up to the front and I accepted Jesus in my heart, just tears streaming down my face. Like, it was a super emotional moment that I can feel it and smell it right now.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, baptized, and then just I was in church for the rest of my childhood. And it was only after I left my parents' home that I started discovering that there were other people with other views. Go figure.
Interesting.
But I guess what I want to know is if you think that religious indoctrination is really only maximally effective on children who are really too young to question it, like that whole person in authority type of reverence.
I think it's most effective. I wouldn't say it's only maximally effective on children, because obviously it works on some adults too. It works on a lot of adults. But I think, I mean, it's not a coincidence that so many churches and religious organizations want to get the message to children and want parents to share their faith with their children. And if you please, in this particular way,
right.
You know, I don't think that's a coincidence. I'm not cynical enough to believe that every single pastor or every single evangelist is consciously scheming to indoctrinate all the children, you know, like, well, we've got them now. You know what I mean? I think that's part of, I think it's naturally just what they do. And well, I think
they've got to build that army of God. I mean, yeah. get them while they're young is a phrase for a reason.
Yeah. Because it works.
Right.
Because you get them before they have the tools to question it and before they know any different, before they know that there are not just people who don't believe, but there are people who believe, but believe totally different stuff.
And they're as convinced that their stuff is right as you are.
Yeah. So, and you know, if you do know that those people exist, it's just sort of brushed aside like, oh yeah, they're, you know, okay. They're Jewish people. Well, they believe something a little different or like, they're Hindus. They believe something a little different.
Right. And I was talking to, Bryce Blankenagel and I was like, did you knew that, like all of us Christians thought that you Mormons were just going to hell because you were fucking crazy. Right. And that's really how it was. Like when you did encounter somebody who believed something else, your parents or your preacher or your Sunday school teacher would be like, oh, no, honey, they're wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. They believe what they believe, but we're right.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Why are we right? Well, we just are. Our side is the right side. Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is when that subject comes up in the apologetics books, that's usually the argument that is made. I mean, it's phrased a little more intelligently and it's, you know, framed in a way to make it sound like more of a sophisticated argument, but it's basically, oh yeah, there's other religions, but they're all wrong.
Yeah.
Our religion is the one right one.
Right. You know? Well, it's because our book says it is.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, the Bible is true, see, and the Quran isn't. So that's the difference. Oh, okay.
Well, the Bible was written before the Quran, so, you know, you can't go believing cheap knockoffs.
Yeah, so, okay, well, then, so what, the Upanishads, right? Weren't they predate the Bible, don't they? I mean, something. There's lots of religious scriptures that come before. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think you have to be a child to be convinced by it. But I think, yeah, there's a reason why they want to, there's a reason why they have children Sunday school. I'll put it that way. They want to start them down that path as early as possible. So that, as it was in my case, like, even though I didn't go to church and I wasn't indoctrinated in that way, I mean, I just, for most of my childhood, I never even questioned it. Like, it was just the way things were. There was God and there was Jesus and the Bible was true. And, you know, Adam and Eve were the first two people and Jesus died on the cross and came back after 3 days. Like this, it was just, that's just the way it was.
Amen. You know?
Yeah, it's just the way it was. And if I had been told that story for the first time when I was 30, you know, I would have said, what are you, who are you fucking kidding? None of that happened.
That's especially if you had never been exposed to it. And I think that that's what, you know, when you're a child, you have this imagination and you're just kind of figuring out the world and you don't know everything out there and you're daily, you're discovering new things. And so when somebody tells you a donkey was talking, then you're like, holy shit, I want to see a donkey talk. Like, that's cool, right?
Yeah.
So it's easier to buy into it. But I think that, you know, when you are a teenager or an adult and you're encountering this stuff for the first time, or maybe you've just got a vague concept of it and people are starting to try to hammer this into your head, like, do you kind of have to be susceptible to wishful thinking already for this to work?
I think it helps. I mean, again, I don't want to say yes, you have to be, but I do think that in a lot of cases you're either susceptible to wishful thinking or you're susceptible to the idea that religion offers to people and that a lot of apologists will blatantly make the case that, well, this is something that can make your life make sense. You know, right. when you're a teenager and you're growing and you're changing and your life feels very uncertain and you don't know who you're going to be and you're beset by all of these problems that in that moment in your life feel like they're just the most important things in the world. And you have no idea how, you know, you want to get away from your parents. You don't like going to school. You don't, you know, if you're an alienated teenager and someone comes along and says, well, here's something that can make your life make sense. Here's something that if you accept this as the truth, then you can be a part of something greater and you can be a part of something that accepts you for who you are, although not really, but well, but in a way, right?
It accepts you for who you are after you change for us.
Yeah, exactly. Once right. you change into the way you're supposed to be, it accepts you for who you are. And, you know, I think there's an element of that that is appealing. You know, the idea that there's structure, that there's meaning, that there's purpose, that you can make sense of things in a way that isn't available that neatly to non-believers. You know, if you're a religious non-believer and you also don't believe in other forms of wish thinking, you don't believe in the supernatural or anything like that, and you basically try to restrict yourself only to that which can be known through science, you have to face the fact that there are some questions that you just can't answer, or questions that don't have comforting answers. Whereas if you're a Christian and you believe in this design that, well, everything happens for a reason and you're a part of God's plan and God knew you before you were born and he counted the hairs on your head and, you know, everything that happens is a part of his great divine purpose, that makes a lot more sense to people. Or that makes it, that it feels a lot more comforting to people than, you know, well, yeah, the universe is really beautiful, but also it's completely, you know, it has no idea we're here and it doesn't care about us and we're completely on our own.
Right. And most of it will kill us.
Yeah, exactly. We have this tiny little piece that we can survive on for the most part.
Yeah.
But outside of that, we're completely screwed. We're, you know, there's nowhere we can go. That's not a terribly comforting thought to a lot of people.
Right.
And, you know, if you would rather just believe that things aren't that way, you know, religion and Christianity gives you that option. It says, well, actually, they have it backwards. This whole thing was built just for us. See? It was fine-tuned to our needs, and this is all part of God's plan, and we're a part of that, and it's really, really important. You're really important. Our planet and our species is really, really super important, you know? Like, it's easier for people to stomach that, you know? But in a way, I guess it definitely helps if you are susceptible to wishful thinking, or if there's something emotionally or philosophically that you're not getting from a strictly naturalistic worldview, you know?
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that pretty much goes through indoctrination as a whole and just kind of like creating beliefs or spreading beliefs. It almost seems predatory in some circumstances, especially like when you start talking about prisons and, you know, outreach programs, you know, like Christian outreach programs or shelters where people are desperate and they don't, you know, they just don't know what else to do or they just don't have anywhere else to go, then it kind of seems like that's where religion just really digs its claws in, because it's like these people can't leave anyway, so let's get them. Like,
yeah, there is something very off-putting about that to me. I've felt like that for a long time, that there's something very off-putting to me about not only targeting people who are in a very low situation in their life and because they would be more apt to be receptive, but also you're making promises that you have no right to make. And that's been ever since I sort of transitioned out of the religious phase of my life into first the deist phase and then now the atheist phase. That's been one of the things that still to this day bothers me the most about the way religious folks do the way they do proselytizing, is that you're making promises that you have no right to make. You know, you're telling people something that at best, in the most charitable view, you don't know if it's true. You might believe it for yourself, but you have no objective evidence to demonstrate that it's true. So when you tell someone, oh, don't worry, you know, God loves you, and if you give your life to Christ, you'll have, you know, eternal life in his glory forever and ever, you don't know that that's true.
Right.
And you're promising it to someone on God's behalf, you know, and you have no right to do that. And that just, that has always bugged me. It bugs me when people do that in general. And it's especially offensive to me when people do it to someone who is, you know, someone who is sick or someone who is in prison or someone who is poor or someone who lives with a disability or is in some other kind of very difficult life situation. And you're finding them at their low point. And from the perspective of the religious person, they're giving that person hope. They're telling them about God. They're giving them a reason to go on and giving them a sense of their place in the universe. And they think they're doing something really good.
Right.
But from my perspective, it's, yeah, but you're saying things you have no right to say. Like, even if I trust that your intentions are good and you're just trying to help and you think you're doing a good thing, don't you see that you're telling a person something that you don't know and that you can't know? As though it's the truth. And that always has bugged me.
Right. Yeah, me too. We're definitely in the same boat there.
Well, and it's like the same deal that televangelists do, where they say, if you give me so much money, then God will bless you this much. Like, that's a lot more blatantly predatory than some of the other things, like a prison outreach ministry. That's not usually as blatantly predatory in the send me your money way as right. a televangelist would be. But still, it's that same sort of deal as, you know, here's the deal. And here's what you do, and then God will give this to you in return. And it's like, even if you believe that, you have no right to promise that.
Well, but it's planting seeds.
Yeah. Yes.
Dude, what do you have against seeds?
I know, right? Don't you like trees?
Don't you? You know, trees become seeds. What is wrong with you? Trees become seeds. Oh, my bad. Seeds become trees.
There's your science education.
Yeah, I know. I am science literate. Trees become seeds.
Trees become seeds.
Checkmate.
Yeah. That's, you know, they probably get that bit right at Liberty University. I wouldn't want to go any further than that. I'm not comfortable endorsing their science program any further than they probably know what the deal is with trees and seeds.
Probably. But yeah, hey, you know, probably. I actually did apply to Liberty University when I was still in high school. I was going to go there.
I know someone who went there.
Ooh.
Yeah, someone in my family went there. Yeah, yeah.
Well, it. wow. sounds like a great place. Let's just be positive about it. Like a really great place.
I'm sure some of the students are just lovely people. I'm sure there's kids there that are only going there because their parents said that's the only place I'll pay for.
They're like,
okay, whatever. You know, just let me go to college.
Yeah, I've actually known a handful of people who have gone to Christian colleges and they're like, oh God, this place is just awful, but this is the only place my parents will pay for.
Yeah, I'm sure that's the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right. And you have several other video series as well. So as a fun question, I just wanted to ask you, which of your video series are the most fun for you to make? Which ones do you like doing the most?
Oh, I do a series called Steve and Stuffy that is a series of they're basically skits. They're little comedy sketches starring me and the rest of the cast as stuffed animals that I and my wife do voices for. Those are far and away my favorite to do. Those are the most fun. They're the most fun writing. They're the most fun performing and editing and everything. I love them more than anything else I do. And those are the ones that I do when I stop doing the Atheist Reads. I do Atheist Reads from January to whenever I finish the last book, usually in July or August, and then I take the rest of the year off, and that day in my schedule is Steve and Stuffy Day from that point on, and those are obviously my favorites.
Okay, so that's recess after school.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yes. Or your summer vacation.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So where else can we find you and how can we help you?
Sounds like you're taking my order. How can I help you today?
how can I make you happy today?
Exactly. Well, obviously, you can find me on YouTube. And the easiest way is to just type in youtube.com/Steve Shives. That'll take you right to my channel. I'm on Twitter @Steve_Shives. And I'm on Facebook @facebook.com/Steve Likes to Curse.
You made that one easy.
Yes. Yes. You can find me. I'm in various places online. And I it's it's the YouTube channel is very eclectic. Like there's the Atheist Reads series, which again, as we just said, is up to 22 books, and there's Stephen Stuffy, and there's all the other videos I do about current events or politics or social commentary type of stuff. I do videos occasionally about Star Trek. It's very, very eclectic, which can be a turnoff for some people, because they're like, he does this one thing I like and I don't want the rest of this crap.
I really do enjoy the Facepalm 5. It's nice to just kind of be brought up to date each week. But yeah, so if a person were moved to give you money instead of me, you have a Patreon account, right?
I do. It's patreon.com/Steve Shives, and donations are welcome.
All right. Well, we're definitely going to link all of that in the show notes, and people will definitely be able to find you somehow. Somewhere.
I'm going to reach out to you right now through the speaker, and I want you to give me some money.
Plant that seed.
I want you to plant that seed in my YouTube channel and watch it grow.
Ugh, so dirty.
I know. Don't say that. I don't want to plant seeds. That sounds bad and wrong. I know you're not talking about trees.
All right. Well, hey, do you go to conventions, or are you going to conventions?
Funny you should ask. I don't usually get to go. I've been to one or two over the years, but there's a convention coming up next year in New York City called the Atheist Conference, or TAC for short. And you can find out about that by going to theatheistconference.com. And I'm going to be a part of that. I'm going to be speaking, and I'm going to be part of a panel of YouTubers. And it's going to be a really awesome event. It's the first Atheist Conference of that size. It's going to be a 3-day event, and it's the first time that one of those has been held actually in New York City. So it's going to be a pretty big deal.
Pretty awesome. I'm going to have to see if Logan and I can get up there for that.
That would be very cool. That would be very cool.
All right. Well, thank you for your time. And
my pleasure.
I honestly do appreciate being able to talk to you. It was a lot of fun.
Well, thank you. I appreciate being invited. It was a lot of fun for me, too.
Logan and I were shocked to hear about the mass shooting at a Southern Baptist church in Texas on November 5th. On the heels of the Las Vegas shooting and daily news of shooting victims here in St. Louis, it's become impossible not to be angry about the situation our gun culture has created. Obviously, both sides of the gun debate are going at each other, and everybody has their views on this, but I've seen another debate as well. It's about religion. Some Christians have been scrambling to find proof that the shooter was atheist and hated religion and that he was motivated by his atheism. Some atheists have posted fake stories about how the shooter was actually religious, though the latter are far outnumbered by the former. Given that religious people can't seem to grasp what atheism is and isn't, it's not surprising they would try to find confirmation that this is the kind of thing that happens when you don't have enough Jesus in your life. I haven't seen a single source claim that he walked into the church, yelled, "There is no God," and opened fire. Plus, even if he had, that wouldn't impugn atheism. Like we said last week, atheism isn't a worldview. It's an answer to a single question. So what it would indicate is a severe problem with that individual. And that's what we're talking about. A man who was prone to violence against his wife and child, who carried a lot of anger, and specifically sought out the church where his wife's family attended to commit an act that is incompatible with humanist values. Sam Harris once said that nobody ever committed atrocities because they were too rational. When it comes to a person's atheism, that's what we're talking about, is a person who is rational about one thing, the existence of gods. That's it. So who gives a shit if this guy was an atheist? He clearly didn't couple that atheism with a rational worldview or a humanist set of values. So the whole thing is irrelevant, and the argument is nothing more than a religious person's attempt to demonize and vilify an entire group of people they don't even understand, that they can't even define. It's unfortunate that we have to keep having these debates. It's unfortunate that we can't see past our ideological divides. It's maddening that we can't have an adult conversation about the role of guns in our society, even when faced with a pile of bodies year after year. We're not even really talking about atheists versus Christians versus Muslims here anyway. We're talking about the Church of Smith and Wesson, the Church of Ruger and Remington, the irrational worship of guns and the delusion that someday they are going to get to be the hero who pulls a pistol out of his ankle holster or her purse and saves the day by taking the bad guy out with an expert marksman shot to the forehead, after which everyone will cheer and hoist them up on their shoulders and have a parade for them. The truth is, that's not how it works. That's never been how it works. And it didn't work that way in this case either. Daddy Trumpo praised the citizen who shot the Texas killer, but failed to understand that by the time he did this, the killer had already finished his spree and 26 people were dead. So far as we can tell, the guy had no more plans for killing people and may very well have been on his way home to take his own life, as many mass shooters do. This argument between Christians and atheists is stupid and irrelevant. We should all be uniting against the Church of the Second Amendment, who keeps putting us here. Fuck your deadly religion.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
Random verb.
This week, we're going to pick on the Mormons again. Our random verse comes from the Book of Mormon in 1 Nephi 14:10. It goes like this.
And he said unto me, Behold, there are save two churches only. The one is the church of the Lamb of God, and the other is the church of the devil. Wherefore, whoso belongeth not to the church of the Lamb of God, belongeth to that great church, which is the mother of abominations, and she is the whore of all the earth.
Oh my.
Whore.
Wow, that was interesting.
That's really judgy.
Yeah, so either you're religious and you belong to the good church, or you're a sinner and you belong to the devil's church.
Yeah, it's not just that you're religious and you belong to the good church. It's that you are explicitly Mormon and you belong to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Otherwise, you worship the devil and you're a whore.
All right. Well, I don't think that that's what it means. But the whore part is affiliated with the church itself, not with the people of it, maybe, per se. I don't know.
Maybe the devil's a whore.
Perhaps the devil is... Ooh. Oh, man. With all of these, like, crazy depictions of God as, like, not just a bearded white guy, I wonder if maybe there's an alternative depiction of the devil where it's like this whorish lady.
It could be a whorish guy. I don't know. It seems like you hate women.
It says she is the... All right. You know what? Fuck this.
Yeah. So anytime they talk about the church, they always talk about it as a woman because they consider the church to be the bride of Jesus Christ. And I don't really have an explanation for that. It's kind of weird, but I guess what it's saying is the church is not a building, obviously. It's the entire body of religious people who subscribe to that.
Yeah.
And so all of them are considered to be married to Jesus Christ, even though... So if we're all God's children and we're all married to Jesus Christ...
Oh, God. I have no words.
That's a little awkward. One of the main points being made in this verse is that if you are not part of this one church, the only alternative is you're part of this other church. And so this echoes several verses in the Bible, like Matthew 12:30, that says, whoever is not with me is against me, and whoever does not gather with me scatters. So it's a very binary view. If you're not with me, you're against me. If you're not my friend, you are my enemy. It's not like you can have friends, you can have acquaintances, you can have people that you don't even fucking know, and then you can have people that you don't really like, and then you can have enemies. And then arch enemies, I guess.
And I feel like I'm torn on this because it almost sounds a little bit like what we've been talking about since freaking episode one, where all religions are basically like, my religion is the only true religion and fuck all you other guys, blah. But at the same time, even that view is more like, I don't care what your belief is. Everything else is wrong. It's not like you are either for my religion or you're specifically for this other. I don't know if they're calling this a religion in this sense, but affiliated with this other specific thing.
Devil worshippers.
Sure. Except, so anyway. I guess maybe that is what all the broader sense version of that is as well, is if you don't believe in this religion, then you believe in false gods and you can go fuck yourself.
Yeah, because the going rule is if you don't worship God, then you are just part of Satan's domain and you basically are just doing the devil's work. So yeah, if you're not a God worshiper, you're a devil worshiper. Those are the only two options. So another point that I wanted to make in contrast to the verse in Matthew is a verse in Mark. And it's in Mark 9:40, and it says, "For whoever is not against us is for us." So we get this binary view again, where it's like, if you're not my enemy, you're my friend. If you're not my friend, you're my enemy. But this one automatically puts you like, so let's say that like you growing up, you really didn't know anything about religion at all until Christian kids started pushing you down on the playground. But up until that point, you just had absolutely no opinion on it whatsoever. It was just not a part of your life. And you were just like, whatever, like, I don't even know what you believe. I don't even know where you go on Sunday. It doesn't bother me. So you're clearly not someone's enemy in that case, but you're also not part of their group. So you're not technically their friend. And I don't really understand how this weird binary religious view actually pans out, because the verse in Matthew is like, if you're not my friend, you're my enemy. And then Mark says, if you're not my enemy, you're my friend. And so it almost like cancels each other out and just everything is neutral.
It's a paradox.
Would you call that a paradox? I call it nonsense.
I would definitely call it nonsense too, but I think it also qualifies as a paradox.
Okay.
A paradox is defined as a seemingly absurd or self-contradictory statement or proposition that when investigated or explained may prove to be well-founded or true. A statement or proposition that, despite sound or apparently sound reasoning from acceptable premises, leads to a conclusion that seems senseless, logically unacceptable, or self-contradictory.
Okay,
that's a better definition.
Yes, it is. It works. It's almost like it's Schrodinger's church, where it's like it could be a church or maybe it's not a church.
Well,
but
I think
you
it's
won't
like,
know until you look at the church. But then by that time, it won't be a church.
I think it's basically like Schrodinger's friendship. You don't know if you're friends with somebody until you find out what church they're affiliated with. Or if you already know that they're your friend, then they might also be your enemy, I guess.
A frenemy?
I feel like we just made this super unnecessarily convoluted, but yeah, I guess.
I guess I feel like this is a really sad way to go through life. If you're just like, hi, are you my friend? And a person is like, psh, I don't know. I don't even know you. Then you're like, then you're my enemy. I hate you.
I guess.
I mean, wouldn't that be weird?
I mean, yeah, everything about this is weird, but whatever.
Yeah, but it's funny, this, I don't know, it's so absolutist. And this, it's not just the Mormons that do this, it's basically everyone. But just like you said, like, there's this, our religion is right and your religion is wrong. But you have to at least admit that there are multiple religions. It's not like there are only two religions, and they all have completely different sets of beliefs and different dogma and different, moral foundations.
I mean, kind of. It seems like the bulk of at least the Western religions stem from the same like fundamental ideology with
For Scientology.
Okay, well, I said the majority of, not every single one of them, because I don't speak in absolutist statements.
Well, but God, there are only two, Logan.
Right, sorry, my bad. anyway, I feel like they all sort of stem from the same fundamental ideologies, but they have small nuances and differences here and there, and that's what makes them different, and that's why they're so, like, against each other, is because they're like, no, this is the one detail that we disagree on, and this is why our religion is totally different from yours, so fuck you guys, because you believe in the wrong thing.
Actually, that's not wrong. And given the history of the Mormon church that we already studied, it actually seems like this may just be a really like direct jab at every Christian denomination that's not Mormon, because the whole basis of the Mormon religion is that they hated what all of the other Christian churches were doing, and they wanted, a pure version of Christianity that
involved space and aliens.
And stones in a hat. Yeah, I don't know. It's weird. But yeah, this almost seems like it's just like directly poking fun at other Christian denominations.
I feel like that's true.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we cleared that up.
It was a long roundabout way of getting there, but we made it work.
Okay, if you had to rate it on a scale of an alive dead cat to 40,000 different churches.
Your rating system is horrible, and I'm going to go with the infinite stairwell paradox from the Inception movie. That's what I give this verse.
Okay. Now that we've forced our dogma on you for another week, you have no choice but to believe this is a show you love and keep listening to a new episode next weekend. In the meantime, if you want to give us 10% of your income, we'll think you're being a little too gullible. But you can donate as little as $1 per episode on Patreon, just like Gaytheist and Lisa McLean. Until then, if you have questions or comments, please send us an email to podcast@waywardwillis.com. Intro music was provided by Austin Cologne and used with permission. You can find more of Austin's music linked in the show notes. This podcast is a media production of Willis Ware, LLC. All rights reserved.
This has been The Wayward Willis. If you liked what you just heard and you want more of John and Logan, you can follow us on Twitter @WaywardWillis, Facebook @facebook.com/TheWaywardWillis, or @WillisWeb.com. If you want to help the show and have a few extra dollars, you can donate per episode or per month on Patreon @patreon.com/wayward. We'll be back next week.